KLOS HD1, Los Angeles. A Cumulus Media Station. Now, bringing Southern California together for nearly five decades, this is Spotlight on the Community on 95.5 KLOS. 95.5 KLOS. Now, Spotlight on the Community with Doug McIntyre.
As you know, former Assemblyman Raul Abocanegra is out of the state assembly, harassed a co-worker, and that person, now one of the women who alleged that former Assemblyman Raul Abocanegra harassed her co-worker when he was a top legislative staffer, says that she's going to run for the district seat that he vacated. That's kind of fascinating. So let's speak with her right now. Yoli Anguiano is with us, candidate for the California Assembly. Welcome aboard. How are you, Yoli?
Good morning. I'm well. Hello, Leanne and Doug.
Thank you for coming on with us. Appreciate it. So if you win this seat, this would certainly be kind of a sweet comeuppance, given that you are one of the people who spoke out about Raul Abocanegra that led to his resignation.
Right. I was one of the women that spoke out, but it was through the courage that I saw in the woman before me that was, you know, ready to get their valor together and you know, speak their truth.
Now, what was your position? Were you working in the California Assembly? You were working in the, you know, explain your background.
Yes, at that time, it was, you know, around 2008, 2009. There's staff for the assembly member that work in the Capitol, and the rest of us work in the district representing the assembly member. So I was one of his field representatives during that time.
Now, just to make it clear, you've never alleged that he harassed you, but it was you were speaking out about his behavior towards a colleague.
Yes, my coworker. Yes.
And was it an open secret in Sacramento that Assemblyman Abocanegra was, you know, a little too free with his hands?
I think it was. We had no idea in the district office that, you know, there was, now that we know that there was a complaint raised in the Capitol by Elise Flynn Gore, you know, nothing was heard in the district about what was happening. And sometimes that's one of the things that need to be fixed, is that there's not a close connection between district offices and the Capitol.
And now why have you chosen to run, for the office? I mean, obviously Abocanegra has resigned and he's out and there's a broom coming through Sacramento, as there is so many aspects of American life. But, why have you chosen now to actually put your hat in the ring, to use that old phrase, and actually seek the office that he once held?
You know, I have a deep commitment to the neighborhoods of the 39th Assembly District. My running for the assembly, it's really a continuation of the work I've been doing for the past 10 years. I've always held a public service, you know, position in the public sector, you know, being in volunteer-driven community organizations like Comisión Femenil, and moving from a volunteer program member position at a poverty relief organization like MEND, and then being hired on. And, you know, it's just the next logical step in serving my community. And, you know, I want to continue doing the work I do, but I need the resources to be able to do more. And given that, like you said, there's an open seat, there's an open opportunity to run, I'm doing it.
You know, this district, the 39th district, which the 39th Assembly district, which includes what, the San Fernando Valley, the Northeast San Fernando Valley, is that correct?
Yes, we're up in the northeast part of the city of Los Angeles.
And this district has sort of had a strange couple of years, to say the least. We've had assembly people coming and going. Patty Lopez, of course, was a neophyte, resulted in before Patty Lopez was in there, Abocanegra, he challenged, I'm blanking on his name, who was the assemblyman before Raul Abocanegra?
And that's who I worked for. It was Felipe Fuentes.
Right, Felipe Fuentes. And so there's been a lot of change there, which is unusual because, you know, frankly, in a lot of these districts, you're pretty much there until you're termed out. But in this case, there's been quite a bit of turnover. And Raul Bocanegra, one of the surprises of his thing, that he had lost to Patty Lopez, who nobody ever heard of.
Right. Yeah, Patty, you know, ran her campaign from the grassroots level, you know, getting to know, you know, the registered voters, and that's how she was able to win.
We're talking with Yoli Anguiano, who's a candidate for the California Assembly, and her website, by the way, is YoliAnguiano.com. Let me spell that for you. Y-O-L-I-E, that's the easy part. A-N-G-U-I-A-N-O.com, that's the campaign website. Yoli, let me ask you a question for those of us who aren't liberal Democrats. I mean, I always brand myself as sort of center right, slightly to the right, much more centrist. But who is protecting or looking out for the interests of people who aren't necessarily interested in a government solution to every problem?
You know, the industries that dominate the Northeast San Fernando Valley are those in the social service area. And I've also worked hand in hand with, you know, my background is in public administration. So we're the ones that are looking out for the interest of our residents. We, for instance, when I was at MEND, I worked as a job training counselor. Folks would come to our organization to be able to get food and clothing. But a part of our mission was to create pathways of self-reliance. So my duty, you know, being in a position to create a job training program, was to teach the fundamentals of how to obtain a job, not filling out a paper application, but teaching them the soft and the hard skills to turn on the computer, navigate through the internet, submit a successful application online, so that they could, you know, be in this 21st century world using the tools that we have in order to, obtain a job.
And all of that is fantastic and necessary. But
right,
there's two questions come out of that. One is, why are the schools not producing people who know how to do that, number one? And number two, there have to be jobs available for people to fill out. And California, bluntly, is driving a lot of private sector jobs away because we have either tied their hands through onerous regulations or through taxes, and we look at businesses, in many cases, almost they're held up as enemies of the people, as polluters or as this or as that. And that's a real problem because we're not producing enough quality middle-class jobs for people to support themselves and their families.
I agree. There's so many, you know, issues, big issues that I feel that normal citizens like myself, you know, we want to have the opportunity to go to Sacramento, on how we spend our tax dollars and how our money is being used and directed for services. You know, I think that, you know, it's time for the professional politician to step aside and, you know, regular folks like me to start solving these problems. There's committees in Sacramento. You know, there's the Committee of Growing Jobs in the San Fernando Valley, and, you know, awesome assembly members like Laura Freeman are part of that conversation. And to be able to have a seat at the table, to have those conversations and really give the input of what, you know, the devastation looks like, what the problem looks like, I think that's what's needed. And that's why I want to be up there. That's why I need to get voted in on April 3rd.
Well, listen, thanks for coming on and talking to us about it. Good luck in the campaign. We appreciate you being with us this morning. Okay.
And Leanne, power to you for, you know, finding your valor to speak up. I thank you for that.
Thank you, Yoli. You as well.
All right. That was Yoli Anguiano, who is a candidate for the California Assembly. And you may have seen this report about Russian birth tourism coming to the United States, specifically in Miami. This is a story we've covered many, many times out here in L.A. Usually it's associated with either Korean or Chinese women who have been coming in to the West Coast for many, many years. And there have been houses that were safe houses that are set up by the operators of this scam and bring women over usually in the third trimester, with doctors arranged, and they're housed here. They give birth in a local area hospital. They take their newborn baby back to the residence. Sometimes it's an upscale hotel for a period of recovery. And then if they go home, they go home with a freshly minted American citizen for a variety of reasons. To talk to us about this latest incarnation of this scheme, it's a pleasure to welcome to the show NBC News senior legal and investigative correspondent Cynthia McFadden. Good morning, Ms. McFadden. How are you?
Hey, it's great to talk to you. I'm glad you're interested in the story.
Yeah, we've covered this many times because there've been quote unquote safe houses in some cases,
yep.
5-star hotels that have been used as the residences, and you know there's a variety of reasons people do it. Sometimes it's as an escape hatch in case, for instance, North Korea invades South Korea. You've got an American citizen, and you can get out of the country, and or in some cases, it's just to scam, you know, aid to family with dependent children.
You know, it's let's start by saying it is all perfectly legal as long as when the woman comes into the country, she does not say she isn't pregnant. If she says she's pregnant, if she's truthful and transparent, under our Constitution, under the 14th Amendment, it's legal. And, you know, while there were all kinds of different circumstances, the Russian case is particularly interesting to me because these are all, for the most part, extremely wealthy people. What's going on in Florida is, you allude to star hotels, it's really very upscale condominiums. And some of the packages are well in excess of $100,000. Hospitals and doctors like it because the women are paying cash, not into insurance. Obviously, it's good for the condo owners who get to rent out their places. And the feeling down there is that it really spurs the local economy. It's become a super kind of status symbol in Russia to have an American-born baby, especially one born in Miami. There's some great lord of Miami. So as we talk to some of the operators of these, or you know, there are dozens of companies that help women do this in Russia. As we talk to them, they don't want the baby to be born in Pensacola or Tampa. They want the baby to be born in Miami. That's the status.
Is there any indication in your reporting as to what the ulterior motive is beyond status to say that you have an American citizen? Because like I said, in many cases, we know from some of the raids and arrests that have been made out here, there is a very real world reality behind the desire to have an American citizen in the family. Like I said, for South Korean women, many cases, it's the fear that if the Korean Peninsula blows up in war, they can leverage that American citizen in the family as a way out of the country. But in Russia, obviously, with wealthy people behind, you know, forking over 100K, you wouldn't think financial reasons were behind it.
No, but I think it's as you allude to, I don't think it's financial. I think, but Plan B, and that's what many of the women said to us. Many of them said explicitly, I want to give my child the best, and I consider the best an American passport. It gives my child, will give my child in the future options, and I want to give my child all the options he or she can have. So, you know, now one can imagine what some of those options look like. The ability to come to the U.S. and live in the future, should the child want to, without having to go through any kind of, you know, processing. I mean, and then, of course, when 21, the baby can then sponsor its parents for an American green card.
Right. We're talking with Cynthia McFadden, by the way, NBC News senior legal and investigative correspondent. You can follow on Twitter at Cynthia McFadden. That's the Twitter handle. The billion-dollar question, if not higher than that figure, is what do we do about it? Because we're not going to be given pregnancy tests at the airport.
And remember, it's legal. It's legal. In fact, as I say, we talk to everybody in government, you know, from Homeland Security to HHS. It's totally an immigration. It's totally legal as long as the woman declares she's pregnant. If you lie on the forms, then you can get in trouble. It's a criminal violation, but it's totally legal. Now, Donald Trump ran on, in part, saying that this sort of should not be legal anymore. It would require an amendment to the Constitution to change it. And it is ironic, as you saw in our piece, many of the women, many of the Russian women, their first choice is to stay in a condo building that has the Trump name on it. It's got a very high status symbol for them as well. So the president's position when he was a candidate was that this had to be eliminated. He felt it was a magnet for illicit immigration as well. And we contacted the White House to see whether his position has changed, but no reply. So,
well, hey, listen, thank you for coming on and talking to us about it. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it.
Many people have fallen sick with the flu in California. So many, in fact, that pharmacies have run out of flu medicines. Emergency rooms are packed, and the death toll is rising higher than in previous years. Health officials said on Friday that as of Friday, 27 people younger than 65 had died from the flu in California since October. To talk to us about this and why this particular flu season is so difficult, it's a pleasure to welcome back the one, the only, Dr. Dahlia. Dr. Dahlia, how are you?
Good, good. Thanks, guys, for having me.
You know, last year at this time, I got sick and got sick and got sick. I think I missed 3 weeks out of the first 4 weeks of the year. We joked that when Leanne joined the show, she thought she had joined Marinko in the morning because Rob was in every day for me. I couldn't get over whatever it was I got. It just kept coming back.
And I remember.
And now this year, the flu apparently in California in particular. Why California is hit so hard?
Oh, man, everything happens in California. We'll also remember you're the most populous state. So when there is going to be an unfortunate death toll from something that affects the whole country, we're going to see more of it in California. And you guys have gone through amazing stress with the wildfires, now with the mudslides. And we knew that people who were respiratorily compromised would, once they had an issue with the fires, probably be at higher risk for flu. I believe it's something we talked about on your show as well. And it's a frustrating year for all of us because Australia had a bad flu season, and we found out that the flu shot for Australia was only about 10% effective. Now, a good flu shot is about 60 to 65% effective in any given year. So 10% really stinks. Now, they're anticipating in the U.S. that our flu shot effectiveness should roughly average out to the 30s. Still very, very low, but nothing that's very relieving to us or encouraging because, you know, look at the death toll. Three people last year at this time had died, and now we're already looking at 27 people. So we're very nervous about this flu season.
And it's particularly significant that 27 people are dead who are younger than 65 because we know that infants, little kids, and particularly the elderly are very vulnerable to the flu. But I wanted to ask you about this. Why are we seeing so many younger people affected by this in such a devastating way?
No, that's a good thought. You know, a lot of people that are over 65, they're getting their pneumonia vaccine. The number one killer of flu isn't so much the flu, it's the pneumonia. The ensuing pneumonia. And so many people that if they do, God forbid, die from the flu, it's going to be a respiratory issue. And they may blow it off. They may be like, oh, you know what, I'm good. Whereas your average older individual has already gotten vaccinated by the flu, not only the flu, but the pneumonia, is always looking for pneumonia. And so there may be like a more of a hesitancy to go and get seen. The other thing too is some of these strains are going to be more virulent in people that have never had it before. If you remember back in 2009 with swine flu, many older individuals didn't get sick as much as the younger individuals, and it's because back in the 50s, many of this population did get that same strain back when they were teenagers, so they already had an immunity. So if an older person has seen this strain or variant of that flu, they're going to be not as susceptible as somebody with a newer immune system.
All right, everybody in our household, we have our flu shots, including our babysitter. But, you know, my one kid, he's 4, he goes to preschool. If he's even remotely sick or running just a slight fever, we keep him home, right? Because we don't want to get every other kid sick. But we go to school, I pick him up, and there are kids with snotty noses running around. And look, I understand parents don't have daycare, and they can't stay home from school to watch their kid, and they can't afford it. But, like, you know, I mean, we wash our hands all the time. And, you know, they always say wash your hands to try to kill the germs and stuff like that. But how do you fight off against when you're running around and you're in public places and there are snotty-nosed kids running around? How do you fight off the flu?
Exactly. It's almost impossible. I mean, the first thing is at least get yourself vaccinated, even if, and your kids vaccinated, even if the vaccine effectiveness is only 30%, it still offers protection, A, maybe 30% of the time, or B, even partial protection. So, you know, get the flu shot. Next is we got to be kind of rude to people and say, look, you're sick, go home. Coworkers, they use up all their sick leave. Maybe it doesn't renew until the summer, so they're going to go to work because they've used up all their sick leave, you know, going Christmas shopping or whatever. You need to tell people you're sick, get out of here, stay away from me. You have to avoid the bugs. And then sometimes, like if I'm on a plane, I'll wear a mask. I'll sit there, I'll wear a mask. Usually I get then the two open seats next to me because nobody wants to sit next to me because they think I'm sick. But I'll you know, cover what I breathe in. And
by the way, Dahlia, remember to take the mask off before you go into Bank of America. Just a little helpful hint here.
True that. So, you know, also, we don't really take care of ourselves a lot during Christmas time and New Year's. So we don't sleep well. We don't eat well. We drink a lot of alcohol. And now all of a sudden we're in January and coming into peak flu season, end of January, February, and we don't have a lot of vitamins on board. We aren't very well rested, well hydrated, and so we need to take care of ourselves. You know, the more vegetables we eat, fish we eat, the more we take care of ourselves, then the better we're going to be able to fight and have a stronger immune system.
We're talking with Dr. Dahlia Wax, drdahlia.com for all things Dahlia, as always. And how long does the flu season last? When does this play itself out?
All right, the majority of the time we'll see it gone by April, but I've seen cases as far as June.
Ugh.
So October to June, you know,
it's a long time.
It started early this year, didn't it?
It did. You're right, man. It did. Yeah, yeah. So I know.
All right, Dahlia, listen, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
You're listening to Spotlight on the Community on 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre. Make sure you listen.
95.5 KLOS. Spotlight on the Community now resumes with Doug McIntyre.
Obviously, a lot of news going on the illegal immigration front, on the DREAM Act, the DACA kid front, raids at 7-Elevens across the region. So we'll get into all of that. But we start with the deal that is in the works related to the DREAM Act kids. And joining us right now to talk about this is the author of The Divided Era. He's a former chairman of the California Republican Party. It's a pleasure to welcome to the show Tom Del Becerro. Mr. Del Becerro, how are you?
Great. Del Becerro. Actually, Doug, you
Becerro,
know,
excuse me.
I think, no problem. I'm actually from Glen Cove. I think we were born in the same hospital.
Glen Cove Hospital, right. I remember you. You were in the third bassinet. You were right.
I remember you, Tom. I was the trouble.
By the way, where was that pacifier I lent you when I was 7 hours old?
There you go.
Tom, so I've got a piece in front of me from Politico that the Democratic leaders face internal mutiny over a DREAM Act deal. But I imagine that this deal is problematic for the Republicans as well, because the bottom line is that this issue, which we've discussed so many times over so many years, is very controversial. It's very divisive, and there hasn't been a consensus on what to do about the problem.
No, and a lot of this on the right, the problem is they've been promised so many times that there would actually be security. And I think Lindsey Graham said it well. He said, well, I don't want to be back here in 20 years. Others have said, I don't even want to be back here in 4. And that's been the problem. When Reagan did this, all they did was essentially give amnesty to people, as the word was used back then. And then the process started over again. So for Republicans, it would be a double whammy for a lot of Republican voters if they let them stay and then didn't fix the problem. For Democrats, their problem is they know Trump is likely to allow many of the DACA kids to stay, so they have a partner they can deal with. If they turn the deal down now, there's actually people who care about the people as opposed to having an issue to fight over.
Well, and that is that's where the politics of this becomes just brutal and selfish, because there are many people who believe that, first of all, making any kind of a deal with Donald Trump makes them traitors to the resistance. And B, I've always believed that the 7-Eleven raids that we saw yesterday, for instance, the idea that ICE is going to do workplace raids because California won't cooperate and some of the other sanctuary states won't cooperate is exactly the picture images that the open border crowd wants. They want to see ICE going into apartment buildings, into workplaces, and taking dads and moms out in handcuffs and putting them in the back of vehicles, because then they can point to how brutal and racist and xenophobic the Trump administration is in America in general. It's the optics.
Well, they want the issue. There are issues that like gun control or other things that drive out people's one party's base or the other. And the problem the Democrats are facing here on this particular issue is, do they want the political issue this year to fight about, saying they don't care? Or do they actually want to help them? And half the Democrat Party says, look, we can get a deal on the table. You can't walk away from that. Those would be, and they're from across the spectrum. Some very left-leaning Democrats think they can get these people here, and isn't that what we're trying to do? And then others in a Joe Manchin who are very moderate say, we actually should do something here. So it'll be interesting to see if both sides put aside the politics. I'd be surprised if the deal wasn't done, because at the end of the day, if the economy's doing well and a lot of people expect it to do well, then the Democrats have to say that they were at the table for something at some point. Otherwise, they just look obstructionist.
We're talking with Tom Del Beccaro, who is the former chairman of the California Republican Party, the author of The Divided Era. And let's talk about within conservative circles. For instance, there are hardliners. I'm going to use Ann Coulter as an example, who wrote the book Adios America that I believe was influential on Donald Trump to even run for president. And she's opposed to amnesty even for the DACA kids. I'm not. I've been a warrior on this issue, a verbal warrior on this issue for 20 years. But I've always believed that the Dream Act kids, with the exception of known gangbangers, etc., but the Dream Act kids are caught in a situation not of their making. And we don't visit the sins of the father on the son. And that part of a deal on immigration reform has got to include citizenship for kids who, in many cases, who literally grew up in this country, know no other country. Some are serving in the United States military, et cetera, et cetera. But as you correctly point out, we were burned so badly so many times before with the Simpson-Mazzoli Bill of Reagan amnesty that if we don't tie that to substantive border security, including a physical barrier, including internal enforcement and something at the ports and harbors and airports, because about a fourth, if not more, of illegal immigration comes in the airports, then we will be having the exact same conversation again in fill-in-the-blank number of years. We'll be talking, instead of 11 million, they'll have some other number that never changes. But the bottom line is people will get in line for the next amnesty, because people aren't stupid. If they see that this is what we do, then why not?
Yeah, and probably even more so than in years past, because the internet and the media is so large now that it will be more visible to many people. For the conservatives on the right, at the end of the day, if they got everything that Trump did so far and there was a huge extension to the wall, because keep in mind, they're just completing more sections of the wall. It's already started. Then I think Republicans will do well in the fall. But if they face the fall with the Republican Congress not having repealed and replaced Obamacare and not making progress on the wall, that will tend to dampen the vote down for Republicans, because they'll feel like – because immigration, really, that's where the Trump campaign started.
Yep.
It was more about that than it was tax reform, even though tax reform – I worked on it a lot and so very essential.
Tom, what do you make of the president yesterday, or the day before, when he had his televised negotiation in the cabinet room? What do you make of his statement when he turned to the bipartisan gathering of legislators and said, "I'll sign whatever you give me"? Because it seemed to me at that moment, now he said a lot of things that were in conflict with each other, but at that moment it seemed like he was ceding leadership on an issue that, frankly, he's been leading on.
Yeah, you're correct. Look, I thought overall he should keep having meetings like this, because the more the Democrat leaders are on TV on the issue, the more they say things were for security. And it won't be good for the Democrats to be on TV saying we're going to shut down the government unless you help us with DACA. That doesn't sell nationally. So I think that the dynamic is good, because the more Democrat leaders are on TV about this, the more reasonable they have to sound. Trump's a New Yorker. We're New Yorkers, right? He talks quickly, and at sometimes his words get ahead of all of his thoughts. But I think at the end of the day, they cleared it up. And certainly in the press conference yesterday, he made it very clear that go ahead, write whatever you want. Sort of like Ford when he said you can have any
as long as it's black.
Right.
You can get any color you want as long as it's black. That's Henry Ford's quote about the Model T. This is the moment for a deal to be struck. We have a president with all of his flaws, but we have a president that is willing, and he did say this. He said, "I'm willing to take the heat." He goes, "I'll take the heat from the left, I'll take the heat from the right." And because the pumps have been primed, especially here in Southern California, for essentially 35, 40 years, with sob stories in the LA Times and all the media, and they're always giving us Enrique's journey. And all of these stories are true, you know, the hardships of people who come into the country and from terrible circumstances, et cetera, et cetera. But the bottom line is that if we don't solve the problem, we are going to end up replicating an historic mistake. The Simpson-Mazzoli bill offered amnesty for 2.7 million people. And we ended up with anywhere from 11 to 20 million people in the country illegally. And California, progressive, dynamic, poised on the Pacific Rim in the age of Pacific trade, with world-class universities, ports and harbors, infrastructure, and a workforce, has more poor people, both percentage and in raw numbers, than any place in the country.
Sure.
More than Alabama, more than Mississippi. And the reason is that we imported poverty, and we have asked our poor people to compete with even poorer people, not only for resources, but also for housing and for everything else. And this issue, while it's not the single cause of all the problems in the state of California, it's a contributing cause to almost every issue we talk about. Almost every single issue, including homelessness, because as low
and healthcare
and everything else,
on and on.
And the thing is that this is the moment. You have a president that's willing to have people hate him, you know, who's willing to say, "I'm going to be the tough guy on the issue." And if we punt this opportunity, then we go back to the corporatist Republicans like George W. Bush, who were talking about compassionate conservatism, and the only thing that did was cost African-American construction workers their jobs and then make it harder and harder for people to afford housing and schools that fell apart as language barriers increased, et cetera, all the issues we've articulated over 20 years.
Yeah, I agree with you that Trump actually would take the heat. One thing the Republicans should be doing in addition to this, though, because the truth is over half those here illegally don't actually cross a border. They come in through airports
right,
and overstay visas. And if the Republicans were smart, there's no like coalition of people in support of visa overstayers. And we actually can't track these people. And we know that terrorist groups, 9/11 people were brought in through planes, not through borders. So the Republicans would also be wise to upgrade our system of keeping track. You can't go to Italy and just hang out for the rest of your life. They actually track you down and send you home. Republicans would be wise to turn this entire issue to an issue of national security, not an issue of race, by who comes across the border.
Well, it should have never been an issue of race. It was always an issue of nationality. Tom, thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate it. The book is called The Divided Era, the former chairman of the California Republican Party, Tom Del Vaccaro. Thanks so much, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, some time ago we told you that Finland was engaged in a social experiment. They had selected, I believe, 2,000 residents to get a basic income of $16,000 for 2 years, no strings attached. In other words, confronting the challenge that so many communities are facing, where there are people who are unemployed or underemployed, and nobody has an answer as to what the jobs, forget about of the future, what the jobs of right now are supposed to be for those folks. The experiment is, what if the government just gives them a living wage, a sustainable amount of money, and we move on from there? Well, a Bloomberg investigative reporter has done a study of exactly how some of those people have been spending that money and their time in the passage of over the last couple of years. Joining us right now is the reporter for Bloomberg Businessweek. It's a pleasure to welcome to the show, Claire Sudeth. Claire, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Always interested in this story. This has been a notion that's been floated around for a long time of a guaranteed annual income, and that people who would work at some point in the future will do so because they choose to, not because they would have to. And frankly, given the march and the rapid introduction of robotics and intelligent software programs that enable machines to do jobs, very sophisticated jobs that human beings once did, we're confronted with a real problem of what is the work going to be for millions of people going forward.
Yeah. You know, the situation in Finland is, on one hand, quite different from the U.S. because they have a very robust welfare benefit system as it is. But in terms of the economic problems that they're facing going forward in the future, they are very similar to here. You know, I think they are struggling with the loss of jobs due to automation. They are still sort of recovering from the 2008 recession, which on top of that, Nokia's demise in the face of smartphones coincided perfectly with the recession. So they were sort of hit twice. Their unemployment rate right now is about 7%, which is close to twice what we have here in the U.S. And so because of all that, they have more people relying on their benefit system than they had before. So people in Finland have said, you know, this used to be working for us, but we think going forward we're going to have to come up with a different solution.
And this solution was a pilot program. What's the status of it now, by the way? Has it been extended? Has it been expanded?
So it's a two-year experiment, and it started last year, so they're about halfway through. The original idea was that this would be the first in a series of experiments, but for a number of political reasons, you know, Finland has political infighting, as we do here in the U.S., although it's a bit different because they have a number of political parties. There are no other studies currently planned.
In your report at Bloomberg.com, which you can read at Bloomberg.com, folks, you talked with a couple of people, or did case studies of a couple of people. One is Steffi Aronen. Is that how you say the name?
Aronen.
I have enough trouble getting my own name right point. But so talk to us about what their reality is.
Yeah, so I have been working on the story for about a year. I have been following Steffi, and then the other person in the story is a man named Juha, through their first year of receiving basic income. In the experiment, Finland focused specifically on low-income people because they were giving people the equivalent of about $670 a month. And if you have a lot of money coming in, that's not going to really change your behavior very much. So they focused on low-income. And then also people who are unemployed, wondering if, you know, instead of you having to reapply for unemployment benefits and prove that you're looking for work, what if you don't have to do any of that and we just give you this money? Will that free you up to, you know, pursue part-time work, temp work, that sort of thing, that under Finland's current benefit system, that tends to be very difficult for people to do. So Steffi is someone who, she's not from Finland originally. She's actually German, and so part of her issue was that she didn't speak Finnish. She'd never graduated from high school, and so she actually was going through school when all of this was going on. And to explain the difference between unemployment and benefits that she was getting and basic income, I'd have to get a little bit into the weeds, but essentially unemployment had been tied to her role in school. There were a couple times over the course of the year where her grades weren't good enough or she was really worried that she would have lost that unemployment benefit, but because she was on basic income, she got to, like, keep going, and she actually just this week enrolled in a formal, you know, full-time university program so that hopefully in about 3 years she will graduate with a college degree and can become a social services worker.
And how about the other person?
So Yua has a quite bit of a different story. He lives in very rural Finland in a town of about 5,000 people. He had previously, about 6 years ago, he had been running his own company, making these very elaborate high-end custom windows and shutters for people's homes that he sold around Europe. And then because of the recession and a number of bad business choices that he made, his company went under, so he had to declare bankruptcy, and he's been out of work for now it's going on 7 years, but when this started, it was six. And he thought that with basic income, he could start his, you know, start another company, but his ideas have struggled to get off the ground, I guess is the polite way of saying it. He thought that maybe he could do a digital marketing and social media company, but he's in a town of 5,000 people, so there aren't very many people who or businesses that really need those kinds of services. I personally think what he is really good at is woodworking, and so he's actually been making these very elaborate, you know, native Finland drums that he sells on Etsy for hundreds of euros a piece. But that appears not to be what he wants to do as a business. He really wants to get into digital marketing. So he has had a bit more of a struggle, and he sort of is at the same point now on basic income that he was last year.
Now, $16,000, this is the equivalent of $16,000 U.S. It's not a great deal of money.
No, no. But these people were on low income to begin with.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, it's not a great deal of money, and in some cases it's actually less than they had been receiving under Finland's current benefit system. But the idea is that they know that it's coming. They don't have to worry about whether or not they have to reapply for unemployment. You know, if they take temp work or part-time work, sometimes in Finland now your benefits are reduced more than that new work can make up. So you actually end up losing money if you take part-time work, which is what Finland is trying to fix. And these people know, okay, this money is coming. Anything that I earn on top of that is extra for me. So that's good.
We're talking with Claire Sudeth, who's a reporter for Bloomberg Businessweek. And you can follow her on Twitter at Claire Sudeth, S-U-D-D-A-T-H. That's the Twitter handle. Is there a demographic divide here between, I mean, if I may, like Steffi going to school sounds like she's probably on the younger scale, whereas the second person may be an older guy?
No, they're actually about the same age. They're both in their late 30s.
Oh, okay.
They both have children. Yeah. It's actually just sort of, you know, their personal lives, and some people are pursuing a more, what I would call, you know, feasible path towards a career, and Yua is trying to go about it the very difficult way. You know, he lives in a very rural area of the country. He has six children. He's married.
Wow.
His wife works. She's a nurse. So, you know, and Finland is giving this to individual people. So if you're a married couple, Steffi is getting it and not her husband, because he has a job. Yua's wife has a job and he does not.
Claire, thank you so much. This is a fascinating report, and you can read it at Bloomberg.com. What if everyone got a monthly check from the government? We appreciate your time this morning. Thank you. If you remember, in the immediate aftermath, we were on the air, we did the special election night coverage. In the immediate aftermath of the election being called for Trump, the futures market sank like the Edmund Fitzgerald.
Oh, the international markets, the Asia tanked.
Plunged like 900 points. And by about noon, when the sun had come up, everything had recovered, and it's been mostly full speed ahead since then. In fact, the fastest 1,000-point gain in the history of the Dow, crossing the 25,000 barrier for the first time ever. Well, how high is high? There's a piece in Bloomberg that says that Wall Street's rising euphoria may spell trouble for a stock market. And all of this, of course, is the whole fear of a bubble. Let's talk about this with the chief economist, the U.S. chief economist at Mizuho Securities, Steve Ricciuto. Steve, good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm well. Yourself?
Thanks for coming on with us. Appreciate it. There's always going to be a market correction. It has to happen inevitably. And of course, if we had the crystal ball and we could tell you on what Thursday at 1:15 when the trouble starts, well, then you become one of those legends. But unfortunately, I don't have that capacity.
I don't either. But I think the point you're getting at is one that, you know, what could trigger the type of correction you're talking about. Clearly, markets are expensive, and the market has had a hell of a run for it. And the question is, what could trigger a correction in the market? And I think it's rising interest rates.
That's interesting, because the Fed, obviously, for many, many years, we were almost paying people to take money from the Federal Reserve. The interest rates were so low. So, as the economy recovered, we know that Janet Yellen has been slowly bringing up the prime rates. And that's your concern, as opposed to, for instance, a bubble being exposed. In 2008, whether it was Bear Stearns or Lehman Brothers or the housing bubble obviously bursting, it's not something like, for instance, cryptocurrency cratering, which is the biggest bubble anybody's ever seen.
Well, the reality is bubbles typically tend to burst when there's a reason for it. And the reason tends to be a rising interest rate environment, whether it's short-term interest rates or long-term interest rates. There's been a number of changes in people's expectations with regard to longer-term interest rates. China has announced recently that it's backing away from its purchases of treasuries. The Japanese have kind of backed away from their purchases of treasuries. And those are two very, very large purchasers of the marketplace. And the result is we've gone to some very, very important levels. And I think we're going to test the 263 level, which is an important critical yield level on the 10-year note later this week. I think it'll hold, but I think we're eventually moving up towards 3%, probably somewhere within the first, if not the early part of the second quarter of this year.
We're talking with Steve Ricciuto, who's the U.S. Chief Economist at Mizuho Securities. Steve, as we move into later into the year, we're going to have a midterm election. The Democrats obviously would like to retake the House, and theoretically they have a shot at that. What about political instability? The markets have clearly liked the idea of President Trump. If not his style, they like the regulations being cut. They like the tax cuts. Do they fear that if the Democrats take the House, could that impact the markets in terms of how people are responding?
Well, there's no doubt that the markets like the whole concept of a pro-growth Trump agenda that was out there relative to the anti-business Obama agenda. Taking back the House just simply means that you wind up, if the Democrats were to be able to do that, just simply means that you're in a position where you can stymie the policies of the pro-growth orientation. But the market tends to not have a real problem with, a lack of policies coming out of Washington. But I don't think, taking over the House would lead to negative policies coming out of Washington. Would it be an excuse to go ahead and trigger a correction? Sure, it would be. But we still have quite some time to go before the election process.
Talking with Steve Ricciuto, is there anything, right now, let's face it, most of us have 401ks, or let's put it this way, half of Americans have 401ks, half of America is invested in the market. And we really almost have no choice now because we have de-incentivized savings. It wasn't my choice. I wasn't invited to that meeting. But the interest rates on savings doesn't even keep up with the inflation, so you're an idiot for keeping money in the bank. Whereas, there was a time not that many years back when the phrase, it's like money in the bank, was a sure thing. It was an expression of confidence. So as a result, many, many millions and millions of us are heavily invested. Literally, our futures in many cases are riding on what the markets do. And we've been burned a few times. The trauma of what happened in 2008 has left a mark, a psychological mark, on a lot of people. They really worry about this.
Well, that's one of the reasons why a lot of the investments that have been done in ETFs. The whole concept is I can't pick the market. I might as well just be involved in the market in general. And on average, you know, that's done fairly well for people. But as you said, it hasn't done as well with new averages, once you include the major meltdown that took place between 2007 and 2009. The reality of the situation is, though, yes, people do need to be invested. And there are a lot of people who have been underinvested. And the concentration of the investment is very, very much up the income strata. But people have also lost wealth in their homes, too. People also don't have the same attitude towards home investing as they did before. Homes are no longer perceived as a store of value because we've seen that home prices can crater as well, and that's an illiquid market. So I think what you're really seeing is, even though, you know, money in the bank isn't necessarily good, it is a very, very safe place to hold some of your assets. And I think in the environment we're going to be dealing with in terms of rising interest rates in the next couple of weeks and months, it's going to make sense to hold a little more cash to put it to work at better yield levels.
All right. Listen, Steve, thank you so much for coming on with us. We appreciate it. From Mizzou Securities, Chief Economist Steve Ricciuto.
This has been Spotlight on the Community, 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre, Talk Radio 790 KBC.